everyone. Well, welcome to Stutter Talk, episode 599 for September 25th, 2016, the Fluency Bank edition. I'm Peter Reitzis here in Carrboro, North Carolina, using some good voluntary fake pseudo stuttering. And I'd like to welcome back great friend of the show, Dr. Nan Bernstein Ratner. Hey, Dr. Ratner.
Hi, great to talk to you again.
It's great to have you on. I think we've been talking. I've been trying to get you on air for about a year now to talk about your Fluency Bank, and you're in the process of launching this great endeavor now. So we're going to be talking all show about this work of yours.
Yep.
So just some quick announcements. The Jewish New Year is almost upon us. So to those who celebrate, we wish a happy, healthy, and wonderful Rosh Hashanah. The next episode, Stutter Talk at episode 600, will be hosted by the Stutter Talk B team. Karen Roisin and Joel will be answering listener questions. Leave your questions for the B team at the Stutter Talk podcast Facebook group, or send an email to bteam@stuttertalk.com. Last announcement. I'm going to announce some speaking goals today, because even though we're almost at episode 600, I still work on stuff, Nan. I bet you do too.
So do I.
I am not done. I am still working. Here are my three goals for today. I'm going to take my time, I hope. I'm going to try not to say because I'm tired of hearing myself say And I'm going to try to really listen to you, Nan, because sometimes it's hard to prepare the next question and listen. And I'm going to really try to put on some good listening ears today. So here we go. Dr. Nan Bernstein Ratner is a professor in the Department of Hearing and Speech Sciences at the University of Maryland, College Park. She is a fellow and honors recipient of the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, that's ASHA. Dr. Ratner is co-author with Oliver Bloodstein of a handbook on stuttering in its sixth edition. This is one of the most respected and cited stuttering texts of our time. And with Brian McWinney, please correct me if I said his name incorrectly.
That's exactly right.
Great. And so with Brian McWinney of Carnegie Mellon University, Dr. Ratner manages Fluency Bank. You've done so much more. Like, I know you because of stuttering, but many other people know you for your work in language development and disorder. So you've got your hat in a lot of rings. I don't know. I just made that expression up. So you're on air because we're going to talk about this amazing project, Fluency Bank. Let me briefly bring it in and then I'll ask you about it. So the Fluency Bank, so go to talkbank.org and click on Fluency Bank. Talkbank.org is a shared repository for existing and future data relevant to fluency and stuttering research. This initiative will track fluency development in typical children, those who stutter, late-talking children, and children raised bilingually. Fluency Bank seeks to illuminate the various conditions that may impact fluency, such as language impairment, language competition, planning processes, linguistic structures, and conversational pressures. This is all right in your wheelhouse, Nan. So, in your own words, what is Fluency Bank and what motivated you and your team for launching this?
Okay, I'm actually going to take us back about 30 years because the organization or the initiative we call TalkBank these days actually started more modestly with something called the Child Language Data Exchange System, or CHILDIS. And it started in the mid-1980s when many of your listeners were not even alive. What was going on at that point is that child language research, child language development and disorders research, was beginning to feel that it was becoming hampered, that people were starting to reinvent the wheel every time somebody did research, and that it might be a good idea if people could contribute data to a shared site, and then they could exchange it and share it amongst themselves to do more informative research. Over the years, that original initiative, which was funded by the MacArthur Foundation and the NIH, has grown to include now five banks. It has expanded so that it now includes something called Aphasia Bank, which studies language impairment in adults. It includes something called FON, which studies speech sound development, articulation development, and disorder. It includes something called HomeBank, which archives records of home language environments recorded through what are called LENAs, which is a sort of a complicated thing I don't think I'll get into right here, and now Fluency Bank. Basically, I've been associated with the Child Language Initiative since I was a graduate student in the 1980s. And, well, actually, I was a graduate student in the 1970s and joined the initiative when it first started. Over the years, I've recognized what benefits lie in researchers sharing with one another rather than keeping their work hidden in their own file cabinets. And so it's been a long-term goal of mine to try and get something like Fluency Bank going. And we've been very fortunate that Carnegie Mellon has also had that desire because they have the credentials that would allow us to do it better. If we were a freestanding kind of organization, it wouldn't be as efficient as it's going to be. So it's been a long time coming. Our big goal is to do a lot of help to science, but I'm also going to talk a little bit about the fact that we hope to do some to create some help for teaching in fluency and fluency disorders, as well as actually consumer self-help.
Hmm. And congratulations, because it looks like you've received support from the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders and the National Science Foundation. Those are no slouches. That's kind of a big deal, right?
Yeah, actually, we were amazed. It's kind of traditional in some fields to send an application to both institutions the way you buy multiple lottery cards, because you know your chances of getting anybody to give you an award is so slim. And we were both gratified by the double awards as well as by the reviews, which basically said, this is a great idea and its time has come.
Hmm. And just to remind folks, the website talkbank.org, and then click on Fluency Bank, talkbank.org, and click on Fluency Bank. Sorry to put you on the spot, but I'm curious, have you gotten any big researchers or research teams on board with a commitment to use Fluency Bank?
Yes, we actually have. I won't mention people by name because one of the things that we need to do with everybody is we need to work through basically what media will come up, what research will come up and get uploaded. Also, what kinds of IRB protections or amendments need to be in place. But I would actually say that, and many of your listeners are fellow labs around the world, and I have been in touch with virtually all the major labs in fluency and stuttering research over the past few months. Actually, the grant only kicked off financially on around September 1st, but we have been laying the groundwork since early summer, and most labs are very, very desirous of contributing and are actually making independent steps with me and with Brian to get their information in a format and to get the appropriate clearances to put stuff up. If you go to the website right now, it's sort of a work in progress. And it's a little bit more interesting for some of your listeners to go to some of the other TalkBank sites and look at what's there, because that's the sort of future vision for Fluency Bank.
Hmm. Yeah, it's. I'm really looking forward to being able to explore Fluency Bank when you get some more data up there. So Nan, in the Fluency Bank, it looks like you're going to have research submitted and archived that's not directly dealing with stuttering. Why is that?
So one of the scientific bases for both NSF and NIH giving us this money is that increasingly over time, we realize that it's not enough to simply talk about people who stutter and people who don't stutter. Both clinically and otherwise, we see many people who don't have perfect fluency, but they don't stutter. So it's not atypical for people to sound very disfluent in learning a second language. We know from the work that I've done and other people have done that children with language problems often have fluency issues. there are some really interesting observations being made about people with ASD, autism spectrum disorder, and atypical forms of disfluency. So what we're proposing, and there is a pure research component to one aspect of the funding, independent of the site, independent of Fluency Bank, there's actually a research study being done here, that we're trying to bring in research from all forms of fluency development and disorder or atypical fluency, so that we can look for common factors and we can look for unique factors so that we can try and understand things better. Let me give you a tangible example.
Yeah.
Courtney Bird, who does a lot of work on bilingualism and stuttering, has definitely shown that many people find it difficult to distinguish between limited English proficiency and stuttering. And clinicians may get referrals for a child who seems to stutter, who doesn't really stutter at all if you're an expert in our field, but the layperson can't tell. And so one of the things we're trying to do is try and figure out how to describe various forms of fluency breakdown, whether or not many of them share features or whether or not they don't share features, so that we can do better research.
And I know this wasn't your direct point, but I just want to share with you that sometimes with the bilingual preschool stuttering, I find that the layperson can tell better than the professional, because I've had cases where I get a preschool child who stutters on my caseload, but they don't stutter. And then you go through the file and the mom's saying, no, 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 he's not stuttering. And the therapist is saying, no, 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 he qualifies as a stutterer.
Yeah.
And I've seen that too. So, but anyway, but that's for another day.
Yeah, going to be something that we're going to be able to come back and talk about with you, because that's part of the goal, is if we archive enough stuff in one place, I know that sounds very non-sophisticated, but if we collect the data in one location and we get the researchers in limited English proficiency and second language learning and language disorders to actually interact with both the researchers and the data for people in stuttering and cluttering, we think that everybody's going to learn a lot rather than having everything again be investigated just on its own.
This is Stutter Talk. Peter Reitz is here with Dr. Nan Bernstein Ratner. The listeners might not know that you are my go-to person for anything dealing with childhood stuttering or language. I have a lot of advisors at Stutter Talk, but you are one of the top three or four most contacted. So
thank you.
Thank you very much. So related to what we were just discussing, could Fluency Bank be a way to add oversight or perhaps different viewpoints to published researchers, to published research? For example, could researchers begin to use Fluency Bank to suggest different findings for published research?
Actually, what we find with more than 30 years of experience with the Child Language Data Exchange System, where one of my data sets was one of the first ones up there for my dissertation work on child language development, my work has been used by, it's estimated my work has been used in over 100 publications by other people. Usually, it hasn't been used to argue any of the points I made. It's been used to sort of investigate new questions. And it is possible, and we've seen people provide alternative explanations for published research when they use TalkBank resources. But it's all done in a fairly friendly fashion. And you are supposed to, you must cite the research that you're using. So nobody's capable of taking my research, for instance, and appropriating it as though it's theirs. They have to cite it. But I think the issue here is that although many people in a venture like this originally fear that somehow people are going to take their published work and somehow turn it inside out and upside down, that actually does not turn out in most cases to be what happens. Occasionally what happens is people will publish something that will say an alternative view of the findings might be because I looked and I found this as well.
So really Fluency Bank might allow a person to use old research or research that was just done to offer additional findings of
right. And And to also get, this is a very important factor in our field, to get more statistical power to look at certain questions. So in our field, we tend to have very small subject sample sizes when we publish research. We don't, for instance, usually have like 100 speakers in a condition. What we can do using the banks is we can combine resources to ask questions. And I can give you a tangible example from a project, and these data will be going up on the Fluency Bank site probably within the next year. So a while back, a student working with me had a question about children who stutter and their language ability. And she wanted to look at a fairly uncommon behavior in young children learning language. And what I said to her is that although I personally had data, I didn't have anywhere close to enough children in my data to probably find what she was looking for. So I called three different other colleagues of mine at three different universities. And I asked if they were willing to send me copies of their data for this student to use, and that we would obviously make everybody an author on the study. And that happened. We got over 60 children as opposed to 15 that we could look at. And when we had 60 children, we actually found something interesting and we published it in JFD. And so that was an example of what I would call an informal pre-fluency bank arrangement, where you had to get on the phone and people had to email you transcripts. And it all worked out and everybody was really happy. Four people got publications they wouldn't have gotten otherwise. And we think we found something interesting, but it shouldn't have to be that way. It should be more institutionalized, and people that have been using the TalkBank resources for the past 30 years know that, and it's helped them.
And I didn't mean to be conspiratorial or anything by saying that perhaps one could use Fluency Bank to challenge research or to look at it differently. I kind of was thinking of things like, let's say a child was excluded from a study because they didn't stutter enough. Well, mm-hmm. I might look at that data and say, gee, I think that child stutters, period. I think that their results might even be better if they would have included that child. Or do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I actually want to take it in a slightly different direction. One of the things we know about stuttering measurement is that it's highly unreliable. One of the things that we're working with, which is what is going to delay getting stuff up the day before, you know, the day after tomorrow, you're not going to see a lot of stuff up there, is we're trying to get minimally audio and ideally video from many of the subjects in studies where we know that those data do exist. And the reason is that there have been plenty of studies, most notably carried out by Roger Ingham and his associates, where it turns out people are not very good and reliable counters of behaviors. So somebody's estimate that a child didn't stutter enough might actually, like you said, you just gave the example, you might listen and you might hear something very different. I've often questioned when I've seen results in print from various labs that I didn't think they actually had people who stuttered in some cases, that the description of their scores on tests or counts didn't actually meet my threshold. So
I've seen that too. I've wondered about that too. Yeah.
Yeah. So certainly this is one of the things that Fluency Bank can do. It can allow us to sort of either analyze the data without that person or with that person if they're all up there, or in fact decide I don't want to worry about the people who I think are kind of dubious. I only want to look at cases where children have at least 10 stuttered elements per 100 words or something like that. You know, right. You can set the threshold higher because you're allowed now to go around the data sets and pick the people you'd really like to look at.
So will Fluency Bank include video and data from children and the...
Yes.
Okay, so I ask because that's such a rich area of interest in stuttering and language development, but so we will be able to see videos of children at some point.
Actually, there is a data set I'll be putting up pretty soon that will have children. The data from my studies that were published mainly in the very early aughts, as we say, you know, the year 2000 and around there, where I had a series of four or five articles. Basically, those kids are going up. I had permissions even at that point that are consistent with putting the data up at an archive and behind a password protected firewall. So there are going to be children up there. The big problem with video as a general rule is that you really do have to get very excellent consent. Because the data are no longer, as we say in the profession, de-identified. So we are working with groups. We think that a lot of historical data that was available in video will go up first as audio. In other words, we're going to take out the audio because of the problem going back in time and trying to ascertain whether or not the subjects would have granted or the parents would have granted permission for the video. But we honestly think in very old cases, if it's audio only, you know, it's true that you can identify my voice and I can identify yours, but if the question were if we were posted somewhere on the internet randomly, could somebody listen to me and say it was me? And particularly with children whose voices are going to change. So we're going to have multimedia up there. It's not hard to do. We've been doing it in people who go to the Child Language Data Exchange System will see a whole bunch of it. My favorite is the Providence Corpus at that site is wonderful. It's home videos of children and parents, and it's lovely stuff to look at. And it's very rich in its ability to be analyzed. For instance, the kinds of things that people do in homes that helps to facilitate child language development.
Hmm. Yeah, I bet that stuff can get a little complicated. Like I just read about an early rap band. It might have been De La Soul, I think, who's had trouble putting their music on iTunes because all the legal agreements they worked out were for CD and records and tapes, but they right. but their record company thinks they might face lawsuits if they go to iTunes because iTunes wasn't invented when they signed their contract. So
yeah,
but what you're saying sounds very reasonable that video is different than audio.
Yeah, the other thing that we're increasingly counseling people on, because again, we have decades of experience in this, is that most of the cases we're talking about were cleared by what are called IRBs, institutional review boards. And although things have changed over the years, it's certainly been the case for about the last two decades that if you receive grant money from outside, such as NIH, you're actually forced to fill in a form that says, I promise to try and engage in data sharing somehow. The government is very interested in having researchers not put their data into file cabinets. They're interested in data sharing. So usually these days, if we go back to an IRB and we say, you know, this initiative wasn't around when people signed their consent forms, but they kind of signed to say that it would be okay to use their data for educational purposes. We would say that's consistent with what we're doing here, and we're going to protect it with passwords so that only legitimate researchers can get access to it. And it's consistent with the fact that this group of researchers got money from NIH, and NIH now asks you deliberately to do that.
Well, speaking of that, I was wondering, at some point, do you think that the National Institutes of Health might say to researchers, if you want our grant money, you have to be part of this fluency bank?
I don't know that they will actually specify that the data have to come to us, but in every federal grant right now, there actually is a mandatory section that you must complete. What was ironic is we had to complete it for Fluency Bank that says, what is your plan for data sharing? In this particular case, we wrote, this is a data sharing plan, but you actually have to fill that out, and people get to look at it when they review your grant. So it would obviously be part of the feedback from a grant review that if you said, well, I'm going to share these data by sticking them on a server at my university, somebody would probably say, we think it would be better if you shared it with Fluency Bank. Or Databrary. There are some alternatives. The alternatives are not really as well structured for dealing with language and fluency data, but there are data sharing things out there. And so I don't think they'll ever mandate just the site, but people actually do have to explain what they're going to do to share their data right now. And if you can't say something compelling, that can be used against you not to give you the grant.
Yeah, and maybe in the future they'll say things like, we'll go on podcasts like Stutter Talk.
You know? That is absolutely true. Yeah. I honestly agree. So the fact is that people actually do have to say, I plan to share the data somehow, because federal funding, a long time ago, people agreed, it started in medicine, that it's really stupid to fund people to do things that then sit behind, you know, in their file cabinet behind a locked door.
Now, I've read a bit about Fluency Bank. I know a lot of people are excited about it. So for researchers who have data, or they think they have good data, but they're not sure if they have the right rights to use it, should they just go ahead and contact you and say, hey, can we work together on this?
Yes, and that's what they've been doing. That's what they've been doing. And so I've been holding long Skypes with many labs around the world, actually talking about what it is that they have, what it is that probably would be best to think about doing if they want to contribute it. So as I said, most sites that we've contacted have really written back with great excitement. They want to do something. It's actually very positive for the researchers because the data sets are identified with them. So it's actually a form of advertising for the work that they do. So we've been holding very, very personalized discussions with each of the sites.
And I'm not going to give out your email on air because that's hard to write down. But if people go to talkbank.org and click on Fluency Bank, they will find Nan Bernstein Ratner's email address to contact you about this stuff.
Yes, and they can just Google me.
Or they could just Google you. And now I'm not going to say which continent because I don't want to give it away. But when I contacted you about coming on air for this show, you said, well, I can't right now because I'm, and you named a different continent. And I thought, oh, that's great because I know there's a lot of juicy research coming from that continent. So so I'm looking forward to you building up Fluency Bank. It sounds like it sounds like really cool. It is really cool.
Well, here's the other thing. Yeah. That if people go to TalkBank and look around, one of the first things they're going to notice is that TalkBank is not an English-only site. It has plenty of data on language and communication from around the world. And in fact, it has analytical capacity of a very sophisticated nature in at least a dozen languages. And it posts information from more languages than that. So Fluency Bank is not going to look at stuttering from an English-only perspective. That's not its goal, and that's one of the reasons why I was traveling.
Now, just let me ask you a fun question. I hope they're all fun, but this one particularly, why not Stutter Bank? Wouldn't Stutter Bank be a catchy title?
So there are a lot of reasons why it's not Stutter Bank, but the biggest reason is it's actually too small a vision. We really want to be looking at all forms of fluency development and disorders so that we can understand stuttering better. And we don't know that we do that if we don't try and recruit data from other kinds of speakers and other kinds of disorders. And so it's got a bigger vision than that. And that's actually part of what the NIH liked.
Yeah, I forgive you. I just this is very different than the conversations I have.
No, I could turn it around. I could say, why aren't you Fluency Talk?
well, I'd have a good answer, but I'm being silly with you. But like, I get all the time from my wonderful colleagues questions about their fifth grader who has a fluency problem, and I say, oh, you mean they stutter? And they say, oh, I didn't know I was allowed to say that. So like, I literally just get that conversation just happened. So,
actually, you know, I don't know if you'll include this, but this kind of conversation doesn't happen infrequently. There was recently an interaction between the International Stuttering Association and the International Fluency Association, sort of asking why it is that we call ourselves the International Fluency Association, because that seems to imply that we're only interested in fluency. And we politely reminded them that we couldn't call ourselves the International Stuttering Association since they already did that.
Mm. Right. And oh, I get that. My concern when we're talking specifically about, let's say, a child who stutters, is that when you say they're a child with fluency issues, or they'll just say, I'm working with a fluency child. That's what I don't like. It's implying that they need to be fixed or something. And that's a whole nother conversation. But
a conversation, but maybe it gives me an opening to tell you something else that's going to be on the site.
Okay.
So we're all of the TalkBank initiatives have a section called Teaching with Childish, Teaching with Aphasia Bank. We are actually, we're developing right now the section called Teaching with Fluency Bank. And actually, it's going to have some of the earliest data to be posted as well. What we've been doing is we've been going out to self-help groups like the National Stuttering Association, and we've been getting properly consented interviews with adults who stutter, answering some questions about their experiences as people who stutter, getting them to fill out certain questionnaires like the OACs. And we're going to be putting them up within the next month or two for use in classrooms. And one of the things we're hoping to maximize in this effort is getting more information about the life experience of people who stutter, not just how to count fluency behaviors. And so we're pretty proud of that. And we actually are very gratified that after we showed up to try and get some samples from people at the annual meeting, NSA annual meeting this summer, we've had inquiries from local chapters asking if they can contribute samples. And we are going to work with NSA to try and make that possible, because we honestly think that this site could work out to be a tremendous advocacy site in some sense for them as well. And that has happened with Aphasia Bank.
And I still want to get to that a bit more. I just want to say real quick that you mentioned the OACs, which is the overall assessment of the speaker's experience of stuttering, which was, I think that's Scott Yarris and Bob Quisel. And that's an amazing measure, because it's not measuring a person's amount of stuttering. It's measuring how they think and feel and what they know about stuttering. And that's great, juicy stuff. And I was really excited. I don't think it's up on Fluency Bank yet, but you've got a study, I think, in progress where you're asking adults who stutter, or maybe kids too, to answer questions like, if you have received treatment for stuttering, tell me about your therapy experiences and the outcomes of these therapies. I mean, I would love to just sit back one night and watch those videos.
Yes, well, those are the videos I'm talking about. Okay. So we went through a regular IRB process, even though it's not really a study, to develop the right consent forms. And basically, our big problem at NSA was we weren't there with the camera long enough to get as many people as wanted to participate. And I did a certain amount of the filming with one of my project managers doing the rest. And I was fascinated by the responses that I heard, because I didn't always predict the differences of opinion I would hear. So yes, I think it's going to be very interesting for people to pull down those videos. Those are the ones I'm talking about that will be up there. We're transcribing them roughly so that people won't get too lost listening to them. But we expect to have them up there in a couple of weeks, and we will send an announcement when they're ready. We always announce new contributions to the talk banks. And I think it's really exciting, and I think it's really going to improve education for would-be clinicians in places where they don't really get much interaction with people who stutter.
Yeah, I agree. It's very exciting. Here's another one, a great question you have that shows how steeped in self-help you are. If you didn't stutter, what might be different in your life? I mean, what a great question. And you know, a person could record them on their own just answering these, right? I mean, a person could sit at their computer and just answer these questions.
Yes. So if anybody's actually interested, that's not the point of this podcast for me, but if people are interested, here's what they can do. They can write me. We already ascertained that's easy. The questions are actually on the consent form, and we have a WeTransfer site that people can upload their own videos. So somebody can sit in front of their own computer. They can make a video answering the questions. Send us back the signed consent form and the copy of the OACs that we send them that Bob Quisel and Scott Yarris were nice enough to donate for our purposes. They are specially marked so that somebody doesn't violate copyright on them. And we will add them to the group. we're going to go out and do this, and we're going to do it in other countries. In particular, the Dutch are very, very anxious to have some Dutch people who stutter contribute such videos so that people working in the Netherlands can listen to the voices of people who stutter.
That sounds great. And with your permission, Nan, what I'll do is I'll put your email address in the show notes of Stutter Talk episode 599, and folks can also find it at talkbank.org by clicking on Fluency Bank. Does that sound okay with you?
Sounds great.
This is Stutter Talk. Peter Wright is here with Nan Bernstein Ratner. I always mention your publications in stuttering. I'll mention that you have also published a lot in language. You've co-authored The Development of Language, now in its 7th edition, and a book, Psycholinguistics, now in its 2nd edition. And you're also the director of the University of Maryland's Autism Research Consortium. And wow, we don't have time now, but I'd love to talk to you sometime off air about that.
Well, I think for our purposes, one of the things we're trying to recruit for Fluency Bank are our samples of children on this, or adults on the spectrum, who display unusual fluency behaviors, since there's already a growing literature on that topic. But it's the kind of thing that people don't see very often. So we really are talking about one case here and one case there. And we're hoping that Fluency Bank can serve, therefore, as a place where we'll get enough cases contributed to centralize that we'll understand that particular behavior better.
Now, I know you take personal information and the right of subjects and studies. I know you take these rights very seriously. So how can people who are interested in the Fluency Bank access all this audio and video? Because it is password protected, right?
Right. Well, some of it will be and some of it won't. The teaching section videos that we're talking about, where people who stutter are interviewed and give and tell about their experiences with stuttering, those were explicitly consented, where the adults said they know this stuff is going to be up there and it will not be password protected, because we want it to we want people to be able to get access to those materials. So that particular venture, the actual consent form that you sign says that I give permission. It also, of course, says that if at any point in time they want to remove them, all they have to do is contact us. But it's the research data, particularly going backwards, that we are going to put behind password protection, in much the same way that if you go to aphasia bank or home bank and try to bring down materials, you'll be asked to either supply a password, or in the case of home bank, which does daily recordings in everyday life and families, you're asked to actually sign contracts and have an interview. And we do imagine that for some data sets that will be contributed to the Fluency Bank, there may be two layers of password protection. We can't yet imagine how individual cases might need more protection than others. But not everything will be protected. Some things will not be protected at all because the consent has been given, or the data themselves, for instance, if they're very old audio tapes, do not logically appear to violate any human subject protections. So there's going to be a mix of things up there on the site.
Do you think that Fluency Bank might start to influence what type of research is being done in our field?
I do. I think that in general, many of us find that studies often agree, but don't necessarily all agree. Sometimes you almost reach significance on a finding for something in stuttering, but it's not quite there. And that's what the statisticians talk about as a question of power. If you're only looking at 10 or 12 or 15 people at a time, it's going to be very easy not to see the big pictures. So I do think that we're going to start to see what we see in other fields all the time now, which are things like meta-analyses, where people pull data from various studies and pull them together to get the bigger picture. And so I think it is going to change the way in which we look at stuttering, because it won't be as much sort of little dots on the landscape, every study coming up with something different, but things that can reach across the data sets and find more general patterns.
Let me ask you another fun question, I hope. I'm really interested sometimes in the behind-the-scenes stuff. So when I'm at the Fluency Bank website, I don't see any logos for ASHA or the Stuttering Foundation or the National Stuttering Association. I mean, is it – should are you working towards bringing those groups in, or is it not necessary? Are we all just working together and those groups can be separate? Or how does that all work?
So we don't see ourselves, first of all, none of the TalkBank sites take advertising. We are funded by the government, and we're actually, large amounts of it are now sort of endowed over the years. Remember, the big initiative has been going for decades. So it is supported through other sources. We don't take advertising. We don't link out necessarily to other sites. We're still building the Fluency Bank site. And actually, just this morning, Brian McWhinney and I were going through some of the links that we would like to try and include to help people who come to the Fluency Bank looking for information. So we are talking about linking to portions of the Stuttering homepage, for instance, where particular examples might already be up there that people might want to look at. So typically, the banks reference other resources. And we don't tend usually to reference professional groups unless there is something on the group's website that talks about something relevant to the kinds of questions people bring to the banks.
And I admire that. I mean, so it sounds like while you get a lot of support from the government, you're independent. And I like that. I was just curious. I wasn't sure how this all works.
Yeah, no. I like that part too. I think I would go pretty nuts if I had to fundraise for this venture.
Oh, and just for the record, I'm not suggesting that you partner with Asher or anybody else on this. I was just wondering what was in the cards and down the road. And please.
Again, down the road, one can sort of get a bigger vision for something that was just born. You can sort of think of us as having just been discharged from the neonatal nursery. You can get a better idea of what we're going to look like by going to a site like the Child Language Data Exchange System, CHLDIS. And you'll see that there are links out to other resources. They tend to be either research resources or teaching resources or reference resources, but they tend not to involve a whole lot of linking out to professional groups.
One of the themes I've been discussing at Stutter Talk is how people who stutter can pave the road for other stutterers. I mean, this is not just me. A lot of people talk about this. So meaning that when I am open about my stuttering, I might make life better for the next person who comes after me. So by participating in Fluency Bank, aren't people who stutter and researchers making it better for the next person?
Well, that's my impression, and I hate to be to give out a spoiler alert, but that's actually what a lot of the people we interviewed at NSA say in their videos, that they are doing this because they do want to get their impressions out, and many of them were very, very excited about the opportunity to do this. In fact, we actually had parents volunteering their children, and I had to turn them away saying that the consent forms had not yet been developed for that. So I do think that it is going to allow people who stutter, particularly influence the next generation of clinicians, which I think is very important, because when they help us upload these little interviews to the teaching site, the people who are going to view those in large part are going to be future clinicians. And one of the things we're trying to do with those samples is not make them purely, can you count the number of times this person stuttered? That we're making the interviews full of content that really address affective components, cognitive components, things that they've learned over time that they'd like other people to know.
So what about the areas that might be outside of speech language pathology, or at least partially outside, like genetics and the medical treatment of stuttering? Will those be included in Fluency Bank?
We probably are not going to archive those data. Genetic data in particular have their own archives. What we're going to do when we post data is that to the extent there are basically easy data to better understand the subjects, we're going to put them in accompanying files. So for instance, if I run a study and I've given the children various tests and I have their scores, we're going to be posting things like that in a little file with those files so that if somebody wants to do an analysis of the children, they'll know a little bit more about them. They'll have some other test scores to look at to sort of round out their appreciation of the individual who is participating. So we'll try and keep those data confined for right now. One of the questions we got during a preliminary review cycle was, are we going to post brain imaging data? And right now, we don't intend to. If science gets to the point where there's a possibility of linking the things at the TalkBank site to literally a brain imaging repository, we'll do that. But that's not one of our immediate concerns.
Well, I'll suggest to you, just watching the numbers and data at StutterTalk, that if you are able to link to brain imaging stuff, you will get a lot more traffic, because the genetics and the brain imaging topics on StutterTalk are our most listened to episodes.
I'm sure they are. And actually, even independent of linking, if somebody has done a brain imaging study and they've published the results and then they give some of the interview, like speech data, to us, it will be possible for people to bring down the data from TalkBank and then use it to sort of appreciate the published data from that same study better. Hmm.
This is Stutter Talk. Peter writes us with Dr. Nan Bernstein-Ratner. She's joining us via Skype from Maryland, where you're at the University of Maryland College Park. So Nan, I just want to say to you that one of the things I find so exciting about this is I don't really have time to be a researcher, but right now, because of what you're doing, I could be a researcher by using other people's data, giving them the credit, of course, but this is exciting to me.
It's actually exactly right. And people have said to me over the years that they weren't sure how I managed to run a program, be a chair for 22 years while I was still publishing. This is how I did it. In other words, that because these things are computer-based and you can bring them down and you can analyze them. And one of the things I haven't said is all of these programs are free. They're completely free programs. They install on your laptop. They're not very demanding of your laptop. So I could be analyzing somebody's data or my own data on a trip, in a train, while I'm on the phone with an administrator who's driving me quietly crazy, and I can get things done. So yes, it brings research down to everybody's laptop.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think at this point, all the software I use for StutterTalk is free, except for the recorder, which probably cost me $25 to $50, the software. So it's amazing what we can do in our own homes for almost no money at all.
Yeah, this is another thing that we like about having the government support for this and not having to fundraise or take ads. This software has always been free, and it will always be free. And it's updated sometimes on a daily basis. If people find problems with it, we will develop new routines. We will search out problems because that's actually what the TalkBank funding goes for at Carnegie Mellon. It goes for full-time programmers. And so, yes, everything we do is free.
Nan, is there anything about Fluency Bank that you would like to tell us that I haven't asked you about, or is there anything that you'd like to mention again?
Well, I think that the overarching view here is to help the field of fluency and fluency disorders as best we can. We've watched other fields really benefit immensely from the Child Language Data Exchange System, from Aphasia Bank, from FON, and it was, I think, a real earnest desire that we had to try and give that gift to the fluency community. And we're really happy that the government and NSF are helping us do that. We think that it's going to improve what we know about stuttering and what we know about fluency development and disorders. I think that we've also had the good experience of knowing that teaching has been changed by things like TalkBank initiatives. Aphasia Bank is used a lot now in clinical curricula to bring down examples of people with aphasia who are really interacting in ways that students could only hope to appreciate if they go to school in some places where they don't have a lot of neurogenic patients. So we're hoping to help a lot of different communities at once, the researchers, the teachers and students, the community of people who stutter, in that we're recruiting them actively to give us samples that we think we can use, not as much for research, but to help improve teaching. So I think that there are lots of different things going on here. It's going to take a while for the Fluency Bank site to look as well developed as some of the other TalkBank sites, but we're well underway. And frankly, we've had such positive response that one of the biggest problems I'm now having is clearing a calendar to talk to everybody, because I do have, quote unquote, a day job. And so many people are trying to set up interviews with me to try and figure out how to give us data and also to be trained in using the system, that it's really, I'm glad I have somebody hired to help me, but it's still very much at this point the kind of thing I need to do face, you know, sort of one-on-one with the various teams, because we all know one another.
Well, there's worse things than being well received, right? So this has been episode 599 of Stutter Talk. So for show links for Nan Bernstein Ratner's email address, go to stuttertalk.com, episode 599. The website for Fluency Bank is talkbank.org, and then click on Fluency Bank. Dr. Ratner, thank you for joining us today at Stutter Talk.
As always, it's such a pleasure.